everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. We had a special guest this week, Rebecca Balibacco. We forgot to tell her about this intro, so she isn't with us at the moment, but you will hear from us soon. In the meantime, it's myself, Phil and Joe. Hello, both of you.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
So how did you find the session? Give us a flavour.
I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was really interesting, you know, the just talking to Rebecca about her background and what she does in her job role and in her little consultancy business, and just, you know, the way she thinks and the things that they do in you know, privacy red teaming and privacy research and privacy engineering. I thought it was a great session.
I loved it as well. So as a little bit of background, Rebecca has worked for Google and she's now got her own organization in what we call privacy engineering. I'm still getting used to the term, so my mind went blank for a second then. But yeah, privacy engineering, it's a completely new term to myself. And I think Phil and Joe as well, and we learned so much on this session. It much relates to, you know, software engineering and how you tie in privacy considerations into that, into the origins of it. And it's a really fresh, practical perspective on it as well. Obviously, in data protection, we deal with privacy considerations all the time, but it can be more theoretical. We try and help people, you know, in applying that practically, applying the legislation. But I think Rebecca goes a bit further than that.
She does. She? I mean, it's a dedicated role, isn't it? So yeah. You've got a dedicated role in a team or bought into a team as a consultant. And they come in with a different perspective. You know, this is kind of like privacy by design or engineering privacy into software applications. And it was just great.
Yeah. How did you find it, Joe?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I was a bit more of a passenger this week because I didn't really want to input for the sake of inputting, and I thought you two, you know, asked some really great questions, and I was kind of just soaking up all the things that Rebecca was sharing. Mm. Similar to yourself, Jasmine, I'd not heard of a privacy engineer before, so it was really interesting to kind of, you know, understand the sort of things that they do. And it was really interesting to hear about red teaming. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
And about, you know, kind of, I know when you do an audit, you kind of do get your head under the bonnet of an organization, but it feels like red teaming just goes that little step further and kind of actually test things. And it's almost a little bit like phishing, isn't it, in a way, that kind of, you know, puts things out there into the organization to see if things are actually happening. You know, for she used the retention thing as an example, didn't she, of, okay, so this is what you say in terms of your data retention. You say you delete it at this period, but does that actually happen? And I think it's a great tool that organizations probably don't use and probably should use moving forward.
The interesting thing was, can you reverse engineer? Can you de-identify or re-identify that deleted data? Again, that's going a step even further, isn't it?
And here is Rebecca. Thank you for joining us. So yeah, we did forget to tell Rebecca about these intros because we're not always the most organized, but here she is. We were just recapping on the session, just saying how much we've learned from it. And thanks to you, Rebecca, really, you know, you gave a really, it was a breath of fresh air to bring you onto the podcast. You're really natural, you know, you're so honest in what you do know and what you don't know. And I think that really shines through in terms of helping people really understand what a privacy engineer does and how far it goes, and it's just a different brain, and we can really see that. It's just really, really refreshing to bring you on, so thank you.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Yeah, and thank you. I hope I did not misquote you, Jasmine, from one of your previous podcasts.
No, you did well.
Because afterwards I was like, maybe I misunderstood it or said it wrong. And she's like, I didn't say that.
No, you got it right. I was impressed.
Oh, I thought it was a really good point. That was very helpful.
Yeah, no, we really liked bringing you on and learning from you, to be honest. So we hope to have you back again, really. Yeah. You know, maybe you could delve into some other areas of your brain and your knowledge.
Yeah, maybe on AI or ML. Yeah. I don't know if that's of interest to any of your listeners or people who join, but would happy to talk about sort of potential risk and harm in AI and ML, because that's something I'm
definitely
focusing more on. So yeah, would be a pleasure.
Yeah, well, without further ado, we'll let everyone get into the main part of the session, although Phil's lips are quivering, so do you have anything to add? No. Never mind. We hope you enjoy the session, and thank you for listening. Thank you again, Rebecca. Phone and it's blues music blasting through my headphones. Okay. No, it's still going. We'll try and make a start anyway. I'll just block out this music blasting through my eardrums. But hello everyone, welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. This is a very special episode because as you may have noticed, we have a special guest on today, with an impressive track record, including 13 years experience in leading privacy and data protection strategy, 10 years in software engineering, including practical experience building and testing data protection programs. So welcome, Rebecca Balibaco.
Hello. Fantastic to have you on the podcast, Rebecca. Really, you're excited. Muted, by the way.
Hello. Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited.
It's going to be a good one. So before we get started, as you all know, this session is as much yours as it is ours. So please unmute or get involved in the chat if there's anything that you want to say. I know that you have already started that, so probably don't think it goes without saying. This session is recorded, as Joe has talked us through our new privacy notice. So if you've got any problems with that, please let us know and we might not do anything about it, according to Joe. But yes, without further ado, let's get started. So for those of you who are new to the sessions, including Rebecca, we spend about 15 minutes or so just running through the news of the past week, just to keep us all up to date, really. So what have you seen in the news? I know, Phil, you've seen a few pieces.
Well, I was on holiday at the start of the week, and I came back to work on Wednesday, and then I went to the office on Thursday, and it was absolutely devoid of people. So I checked the holiday calendar to learn that I should have been on holiday on the Wednesday. So I don't know what happened there, but so I haven't really been up on the news, but there's a couple of things I did notice, and some of this you may have covered in the previous session, but there was an article about smart cars, you know, and exposing kind of the telematics and the darker side of driving, where information, you know, from the cars is getting hoovered up by car makers and then shared with insurance providers, and people's premiums, you know, doubling and going up on the basis of their driving habits and the kind of things that get monitored, like, you know, braking, seatbelt tensioning, forces around corners and things. And a lot of the article was about America, and Rebecca might have some thoughts about this. But what was interesting is it said in the UK, car makers insist a repeat of these American cases could never happen because of strict GDPR data rules. This means customers must explicitly agree to share their information with insurers. No, they don't. You know, that's just, you know, surely, you know, this type of information is kind of regular personal data, you know, geolocation, driving habits and stuff, probably not special category data, and therefore, you know, could be approached on the basis of a legitimate interest.
I mean, I'd understand if they had, you know, a telematics device. That's completely different, though. That's provided through the insurance for the, is it the car companies that are sending the data directly to the insurance companies then?
So the car sending the data to the car maker. In this case, it was a brand I'd never heard of, Cadillac or something. Is that Cadillac or something? Something you don't often see on the European roads these days. And then they're sharing it on with, sorry, Rebecca, they're sharing it on with insurers. But interestingly, AA and RAC have said that they want access to the data so they can advise motorists of any potential technical issues like engine diagnostics information, tire pressures, etc., so they can advise their members of any wear and tear issues. So some of this seems like it could be positive and some of it seems like it could be negative, which was just an interesting take on the telematic stuff.
In similar fashion as well, I saw that the UK government have decided to invest £55 million into facial recognition technology to reduce shoplifting.
Saw that. Yeah, yeah, saw yeah, that, yeah.
Yeah. So again, we spoke about a lot about facial recognition last week, didn't we, Joe? But
we did,
there
yeah.
are very much positives and negatives to that. Some positives and negatives may be different for some people than others if it's relating to shoplifting, but
that story might cause me some issues, because I often steal carrier bags from shops. I always press my own bags and don't scan the thing. So
oh dear, after
you know what, I'll
do that. Edited out.
I'm gonna have a criminal record now.
Yeah,
that's Peter quite right.
Scan them for you. I had that the other day. I was fuming. 30p
you're not
gone.
Talking about those paper bags you put mushrooms in, Joe, or the salad bags.
No, I'm on about, you know, when you're like, well, they're Aldi now, have someone standing there with carrier bags, and they come and scan it for you, because too many of me have been stealing 30p bags. Remember when they used to be 5p when it was first brought in, and now they're bloody 30p.
Yeah.
That's stopped people. I think Peter's quite right, Joe. You are a badass.
Oh, I think that refers to me refusing people's rights if we have.
Oh, no, but you are definitely.
He's on a roll
today. On two counts, you are now definitely bad.
Lawrence says it's a den of criminality here. It's all Joe.
It is, yeah. We have to get rid of him off these things. I also noticed that there was a big vets group. This is interesting, because the veterinary industry is getting looked at by the Competition Authority. Apparently, I hadn't realised, but there's a massive consolidation of vets practices, and there's two big practices that are buying up independent vet practices. And this particular one, the CVS Group, who had the data breach, they got 500 locations around the world, most of which are in Britain. So anyway, they've had a cyber attack, and they've reported it to the ICO. Again, there's very little information about what was actually compromised. But my first thoughts, we talked about veterinary practices before, and your first thought are, well, it's animals data, you know, medical information about animals, but actually there's obviously a lot of customers, isn't there, a lot of patient data, potentially, you know, if people have got, you know, comfort pets, or, you know, guide dogs for the blind, there could be medical information in there as well, maybe.
So also, it used to be a common security question, like, what is your pet's name?
Right.
So if they can get that and your information, then they can do old two-factor.
That's a great point, actually, that, isn't it?
Yeah. Sorry, I was getting sidetracked by the chat going on about these bags, but that was a really good point, Rebecca. going onto something else as well. So I saw that this might be more relevant to you, Rebecca, in you know, your line of work and customers particularly. But I saw that privacy law has been passed in Maryland, and I saw it on LinkedIn, so I don't know if anybody's heard of Robert Bateman, but he does some summaries on updates and legislation across the world, really, but they're really useful. I'll probably send a link into the chat, actually, and if I can find one. But yeah, basically, it seems positive. There are some progressive steps in terms of data protection, you know, warranted to individuals. So it's a complete ban to sell sensitive data for customers to sell sensitive data for consumer purposes. The definition of sensitive data is quite, I'd say, broad. I compared it against the Article 9 definition under the GDPR, and philosophical beliefs, political beliefs, and trade union membership aren't included in the bill in their Act's definition, but it does account for children's data, and I just thought that was a really interesting point, because we don't really consider, I mean, so children's data isn't considered special category data, is it? But at the same time, we recognize it as sensitive, and we should put in place, you know, proper protections to protect that data. Well, why is it not recognized as such, you know what
and
I mean?
I do think actually that the DPDI bill is set to include children's data as being special category, I believe. Happy to be corrected if I'm wrong, but I'm sure I've read that somewhere.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I'd have to check. I noticed that precise geolocation data is included in sensitive data as well, isn't it, in this Maryland bill? This Maryland law. But I read that and it led me to click on a link to read about the APRA bill, which is the American Privacy Rights Act bill that's been presented, is it this week in the Senate? Again, this is really interesting because we've talked for a long time about, you know, ultimately, you know, the federated arrangement is going to lead to how things were in the EU, which drove the GDPR, you know, this directive based approach where, you know, your local laws had to comply broadly with the principles in the directive, but it meant everybody went off in a different direction. And that's how things are have been emerging in the States with all these different laws. The only way to get, you know, get a sense of this is either to have no day of protection laws at all or to have one day of protection law at a federal level, which looks like, you know, it might be moving that way. Again, Rebecca might want to jump in and say, you know, have a say on that. We're going to put a link into something I found, which is quite a good summary of what's in the APRA bill here. But it'd be really interesting to see how that maps out, whether it gets through the Senate. It's got the support of both parties. And, you know, with the November elections looming, it may or may not get through. So we'll yeah. see.
While we're on the topic of American laws, I actually read in the news that the Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is set to expire, or the sunset clause is, sorry, on the 19th of April. And I think the US House of Representatives arranged a vote on the 10th of April for potential reauthorization of Section 702. So it could include several amendments, one of which would require the Federal Bureau of Investigation to obtain a warrant in order to search US citizens' communications. So I wonder if that's off the back of the suggested amendments that came from the EU-US data privacy framework. I'm not actually sure what they are specifically, but I'm sure I read that's the reason why that got approved, as far as I'm aware. Or that, I think that was a sticking point, wasn't it? With it always has been around the US getting some sort of adequacy decision. So I wonder if that's going to coincide with this new federal bill that you were just talking about, Phil.
One thing I do want to say, Rebecca, is that it's very hard to get a word in edgeways on these podcasts.
So you just have to interrupt.
Yeah. Don't be afraid.
Don't be polite. The last thing that he said, moving on very swiftly, the last thing I wanted to be, I know you've talked about this a few times and I've not had the opportunity because I've been off every time you've raised about this, but
I know what you're going to bring up. Yeah.
this oral disclosure can be considered processing under the GDPR. And I read through the I haven't read actually the judgment, but I did read the Panopticon blog about it. And there seemed to be a focus on the definition of processing at Article 4.2 of the GDPR, you know, processing designed to be broad. But it didn't mention at all Article 2.1, the material scope of the GDPR, you know, and that seemed to be quite relevant because the regulation, you know, is meant to apply to processing of personal data wholly or partly by automated means, whether verbal disclosures, well, they're not automated means, are they? It also includes processing other than automated means, which forms part of a filing system or intended to form part of a filing system. But that definition to me seems really clear, and it must surely preclude oral disclosures.
I agree, yeah, because if you're just having a conversation, then surely it's not caught by the material scope. But if you're having a conversation, like you say, and you make notes and then that's kept on file, then surely you would be caught because intention of it to be filed. Yeah. So yeah, I agree. I think I can't remember our conclusion, Jasmine, when we spoke about it several weeks back, but it is interesting, Phil, and maybe it's something that we should maybe unpick a little bit further on next week's GDPR radio session, perhaps.
I think I'd like to. But I mean, the context of this thing that happened in the ECJ is possibly relevant because it was special category data, wasn't it? But it didn't say that in the blog. I'd have to read through the judgment, but I'm keen to look at it because whilst the ECJ judgment doesn't apply to the UK, you know, we need to know about it because some of us got international operations, and the UK courts might, you know, look to this as some form of you know, guidance.
Now we've hit the 15 minute mark, so I think we should probably
That's
go into
excellent chairwomanship.
The main part of the session. And hi, Rebecca, and finally, we keep, you know, dipping our toes into the conversation. But for everyone's benefit, would you mind just giving a little background to yourself and you know, now, I suppose?
Sure. So, hello, I'm really excited to join you today. I'm sure y'all can hear from my accent, I am American, as mentioned. What is a Cadillac? I'm from, actually, I grew up in Michigan, which is where Detroit is. So I'm like, oh, like, how do you not know the American cars? No, but I've been living in Switzerland for 5 years, so I haven't been fully attuned to American legislation. So I kind of have some, know a little bit about what's going on, but I like, I'm perfectly happy to not make any comments. So I'm not a lawyer. I don't even really work in compliance. My background is software engineering and math. And so I've done work on machine learning, AI, and how do we find problems in software engineering that could result in data leakage. And I'm currently running a small privacy engineering consulting company. And I know I've heard people who are like, what does privacy engineering mean? Which maybe we can come back to.
We love.
Before that, I was working for Google on the privacy red team. And so that's also another thing where people are like, what's a privacy red team?
So maybe
we can come back to that. And prior to that, most of my focus was on how understanding privacy should influence privacy policy, like what are the legislation and what like empirical science is needed. So I would run like user studies and see if people actually understood a privacy notice. And if they didn't, then sort of how should that inform the legislation that we're making or regulations we make about, for example, privacy policies or privacy notices.
Thank you. So I think everyone's first question is, what is a privacy engineer?
Yeah, I mean, that's like a frequently asked question. And there was even an article in like the IEEE magazine just came out a week ago. It's like, what is a privacy engineer? What do we do? And so a privacy engineer is, I think of it as someone who's working on the technical aspects of privacy. So probably not a lawyer. Maybe they could be a lawyer by background. They may be working on compliance, but they're able to perhaps do a code review or to understand what's going on in the database, or maybe to sort of say like, well, I don't think that's the right machine learning algorithm. So they should be able to sort of go back and forth between an engineering team, the software, and the legal compliance program management, and make sure that everything is lining up. Alternatively, they may also be like writing privacy code, right? They may be going in and writing those tools, those privacy enhancing technologies. So that could also be a privacy engineer.
Mm-hmm. So what does privacy engineer your company do?
So I help, I have two streams of work, and it's like really small or really mature companies. So one of them is to work with like startups and deep tech companies to help start thinking about like from the foundations, how can you build your tech stack so that privacy is built in. So for example, like if I work with an AI company and they're thinking about how to train their models and those models might have sensitive information, I can say like, try differential privacy, or, you know, let's figure out what's the right thing so that the outcome in the long run will be privacy preserving. On the other hand, I also help companies that have more mature privacy programs, like perhaps the kind of companies who've like already worked with you. They have a lot of the compliance and the foundation set up. They have clear processes, and now they want to test it. They actually want numbers. Like, I have a retention policy. Am I deleting that data, or am I accidentally retaining it too long? I have a policy around like access control, but is something happening in the system that might mess that up? Like, actually, do too many people have access to my data?
It's interesting. So we had a two-part session a few weeks ago about small versus large organizations and the different implications and you know, challenges that both face. So we gave what we would say is our opinions on what a startup should consider in, you know, in regards to data protection and its first steps. And I say, like, let's say the first 10 steps, what would yours be? I don't know if that would align with how you work. Obviously, you know, you focus more on the technical elements and so on, but where would your starting point be?
So I would start with good security. So that's actually kind of a hard thing for the really small startups, right? For the, when they have like maybe 30 employees, they might have one person who's doing security. And I do think you need security to have good privacy, right? Like prevent those hacks. Mm-hmm. And then I would also go through sort of the system architecture, where, what user data are you collecting and where are you storing it? And there's different decisions based on like, which database are you going to separate the PII from the qualitative data? And I would go through that with them. And then I also try to get privacy advocates embedded throughout the company. So perhaps in the marketing or the user experience, I would have someone who can talk about privacy notice and choice. Like, how do you actually design a usable privacy notice? Of course, they will also need legal review. But I want someone in the company who can have those conversations. I may also work with a data analyst and get them trained. Like, what does it really mean to be identifiable? Like, when you use the term anonymous, does it mean the same as what, like, what I might mean or what a regulator might mean? Like, let's be careful. Let's like understand all these different levels of re-identification and anonymity. Mm.
I like that because it's so practical, you know, your approach. You really get involved in actually spreading, you know, these measures across the organization. I think sometimes data protection can be quite theoretical, especially for, you know, people who don't get involved in it day to day. It's very much, you know, documentation and making sure that you've got these things in place. But a lot of the time, then individuals throughout the organization, not necessarily those responsible for data protection, will forget about it. So, you know, by spreading that across each department, it's really good. Phil, you really wanted to get involved in the other arm of the business, didn't you? So
I'm really interested in that. I mean, one of the things that we always advocate as well, Rebecca, is absolutely the same as you, is we would call them privacy champions. You know, we would say, you know, set up a network of privacy champions in your departments and formulate those into some sort of governance committee, you know, data protection or information governance committee. And that way you've got eyes and ears out in the business, who can then, you know, distribute messages and can feed back into the center, you know, any concerns or challenges or issues. And it spreads the load. I mean, it can be quite a lonely role being a data protection officer in a business. And we sometimes find that, you know, you come into a technical project too late. You know, I don't know whether what your experience is of that, but, you know, and then you're just seen as the blocker. Well, you know, we're ready to sign the contract, or we've already signed the contract, you know. Mm. But what about all these privacy issues? You know, why weren't they addressed earlier? Oh.
So I have a question. When you are advocating for privacy champions, or you're telling people to set them up, are they usually people who are in leadership and are decision makers?
No.
Or they're like more embedded, like the contributors,
the and you've probably got a view as to what works best, but we would tend to try to encourage data champions at a lower level, middle management or lower. You know, senior management, I'm not sure that it makes for a good committee, you know, or good structure, good organization. They don't know the detail of their processing. People might feel intimidated approaching them about things. I can see the benefit of having senior people in the team, but in the main, my experience is that they're usually more junior people. What do you find?
Exactly the same. I mean, of course you need leadership buy-in. Of course you're not going to get a privacy program off the ground without leadership being on board. But for what I call privacy advocates, privacy champions, I like it to be someone where the rest of the team will come to them for a discussion, but not feel like that's going to be the final decision.
Yeah.
Like they can bounce ideas, that it's like sort of a level playing field. What if we do this? What if we do that? But if you're going to like your manager's manager, then things feel different.
Yeah, we try to find, which is not easy, informal leaders, you know, senior people in terms of they're respected in their department, you know, people look to them informally for leadership and for their opinion. They're good. People aren't afraid of speaking out. You know, they're the types of people you need. Otherwise, it just becomes, and I've sat on information governance groups where everyone's terrified because the chief exec sat on it and they just will not talk about proper stuff.
Yeah, I agree.
But I would.
I'd love to know more about what sort of training you want them to have, or how do you find them and how do you get them engaged? Your champions.
Yeah, finding them. We're usually external consultants. Feel free, Joe and Jazz, to jump in here, because we're usually external consultants. We're not usually that familiar with everybody in the operation who might be ideal. So we're usually kind of working with these groups rather than selecting people. We have a standard, you know, specification for the job of a data champion and for a data protection officer. And we've got terms of reference that we would advise our client to implement, you know, so that there's some structure and governance around the information governance committee and clear reporting lines and clear scope of its work and jurisdiction. But we're usually not putting those teams together. We're normally just having to work with whoever has been put together. In terms of training, you know, our biggest bugbear with training is where it's just generic GDPR or data protection training. You know, the most important training is how that has been applied here in this organization, how to report a breach, who to report it to, what form to do, when to do a DPIA, you know, what all that stuff is the most important aspect of the training, I think. You know, the fact that the GDPR has got 7 principles is here and there, really. They need to know how that has been applied and who is allowed to change a privacy notice. Mr. Kirk, yeah, who has got authority to just decide to rewrite privacy information, for instance. You know, these kind of things is what makes a program hang together or fall apart, in my opinion. But
yeah, go on.
I was just going to say, it's going back to that practical element again and actually implementing the law rather than just stating, you know, what you need to know. It's how you apply that.
Yeah, this is actually quite timely conversation because I'm in the middle of a ROPA project actually with one of our customers. And we've just got to the point now where with the ROPAs kind of compiled, I've spoken to every department. We feel like we've got everything, but there are gaps in there. And obviously I've been creating a risk register relating to the ROPA, identifying, you know, where the gaps are and if things have been incorrectly filled out. And like, we're kind of at the phase now of where we're identifying process owners, obviously, who I think probably would be the same people that you'd probably have as a data champion. Would you agree with that, Phil, perhaps? Kind of the department head?
I'm not sure. I think that the process owner is probably more senior, the person that makes the decision about the processing activity. So, you know, why are we doing this and who owns that aspect of the business? That would be my take on it.
Okay.
I'd still feel like a second in command, you know, role in terms of a department would be best there, because I feel like a more senior role are less likely to understand, you know, the details and the ins and outs of what's going on in, you know, in the process and operations within that department all the time.
But if their name's on the rope, if they're on the hook for it, then
it's their responsibility to know.
Yeah, I think that's probably, for me, that's a good formula. You've got a senior person whose name's on it, who's on the hook for it, who, if it goes wrong, is going to get, you know, interrogated about it. So they're probably going to make sure that something rolls down through their department. But I think there's no right answer, is there?
Yeah.
Sorry, Rebecca, we're doing what we do here. We're just kind of rabbishing on about.
I love it. I love learning like how you're doing it. I think it's kind of important.
But the
So I've got a question, Rebecca. So as a privacy engineer, where do you sit? Are you in between, you know, the data protection team and the engineering team? Are you neither nor, or are you both, or how does that work?
So I think it depends. Kind of. Because, so for example, Google had like I don't know, 100 people with the privacy engineering title, and they were doing all sorts of things. Like some of them were like directly embedded in a product and working with that team to like, you know, review what was being built. And others were designing programs. And so it can really depend. Like at a huge company like Google, it's one thing. At other companies, other companies might have people who are doing privacy engineering work, but don't have that title. So, for example, I know some people who are building privacy-preserving machine learning, and their title is research scientist. But it seems a lot like privacy engineering to me. So I think it really depends on, like, the title is still so vague and undefined, and there's still so many people who are doing what I think is at work but don't have the title, that, like, it kind of depends, where do you need it? And I think probably a key point is that, like, privacy engineers are likely the most relevant in the companies that are building software, right? Like, for example, a company that's not their main business, they're not trying to sell software, or they don't have like a user-facing website or app or something, a privacy engineer might not be like the right role for them to try to fill.
Yeah. So at Google, were you part of the red team, privacy red team? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
So I mean, talk to us about that.
Yeah. So it wasn't actually called the privacy red team, and it's just like a kind of, people in the security world tend to know what a red team is, so that's a useful term for them. But for a lot of other people, they're like, what's a red team? That doesn't help us either. So the idea of a red team is that it's sort of like an adversarial, you pretend to be an adversary and you try to find flaws. So it really started with the US military that had the red team, like the communist team, that was going to pretend to attack the blue team, which would be like the good guys. And so that's how you figure out if there's weaknesses, by actually like simulating this attack as an adversary. And so internal security red teams for quite a while have been like coming in and running attacks. Like what would a bad hacker, a malicious person try to do to break into the system? Can I do it? And then we will fix it. Right. And then the question is, like, what can we do around privacy? Does privacy have room for that sort of adversarial thinking? Can someone with knowledge of issues around identification or data leakage go in and do some of the similar attacks as the security red team? So, a few things that, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, what would that look like from a privacy perspective then? What would some examples be?
So I think depending on the size of the company and depending on, like I've mentioned, AI or ML a few times, but if you're not doing AI or ML, like a really classic one is you think the data is deleted, but can I find it, right? Like you have a very nice retention policy. Like you have some system maybe even that is like automatically deleting thing. That's amazing. But if one little thing in the configuration of that system goes wrong, then maybe you're sitting on a bunch of data. You think it's deleted, but it's still there. So perhaps a privacy red team, like user data or sensitive data. So perhaps a privacy red team could go in and like look for that or find it or demonstrate that they could not only see that data, but maybe do the next step with it, right? Like I found your user data and I changed their profile, so now they get ads about whatever, dog food or, you know, like whatever you can I'm trying to make up examples on the fly.
It's hard, isn't it?
One of the things that we've done rarely, which is a surprise because it's something that I think should be done regularly, is testing consent and opt-out mechanisms. So that's probably as close as we've come to red team. And I did a project a long time ago for a big dairy company who'd got into lots of trouble. In fact, that it's in the public domain. It was Danone baby foods division, and they'd got, there was a panorama program about the way they were sending emails and offers to women who'd had terminated pregnancies, early terminated pregnancies. And it got on Panorama. Anyway, it all transpired that the opt-out for their email campaign went to an unmanned email box in South Africa. But nobody had mapped it. Nobody had tested it. You know, nobody had kind of found out that it hadn't been working. And so you know, we've done that a few times, like we've like, just test a opt-out because where does this message go? How is it handled? What other databases get updated? That's probably as close as we've ever got to kind of red team. But I'm really interested with the concept. It sounds like a great, you know, great idea. Like when we do an audit, Rebecca, we kind of looking at previous information and the records posting activities and the actual operation. We're trying to correlate the three of them. So, right, okay, says this in the ROPA, where is that in the operation? And where is that in the previous information? And in the previous information, you're saying you're doing this. Where is it actually on the ROPA and where is it actually in the business? And in the business, you know, you say, where is this activity I'm looking at now? Which roads on the ROPA and in which previous information is that? I love that kind of stuff. But we again, most of the time when we do our audits and we come to retention, we don't. Nobody's prepared to pay for the time for us to actually test retention. We get told stuff. Again, we look to see if it correlates between the retention schedule, the previous information, the ROPA, you know, but we don't actually, very rarely do we actually get our hands onto a database. They are, show me the oldest record in this database. Does it comply with the retention policy? Yes or no? You know, it should be straightforward, shouldn't it?
Yeah. And so another example of like testing red teaming a privacy notice is like you have this notice that says what data you collect, and then perhaps the red team is going to go actually look at the internet packets and say, we see this data being transferred. Your policy says this. Maybe that data doesn't actually get saved, and that may be why the organization doesn't know that they're collecting it, but they're still collecting it. So that like there are all sorts of points where you can sort of go in and say, what are we doing wrong? Just we read the notice, we try to understand what we're telling, what we're promising users, and then we check, is that what you're actually doing?
So when we do an audit, we've got, you know, a criteria that we'll look into and make sure that or check, you know, your compliance measures against each of these areas. Is it the same for Red Team and how granular do you go?
So there's a little bit of a distinction between what's typically called like penetration testing or pen testing versus red teaming, whereas penetration testing will typically like have, here are the 10 things you test. So it's like you have 10 doors and you're like, can I open any of these? Whereas a red team attack might go a little further. They're like, if I can open one door, then I'm going to go into it and then see how much unexpected harm I can have. So I think in the privacy community, like this difference between red team and penetration testing isn't so clear, but typically it's less like an audit. It's less of the like, here's a list of things we need to check. And it's more sort of like creative adversarial thinking about a feature or sort of depends on the scope of the organization. So like one classic feature is these share by links where you like, you want to share your calendar with someone or you want to share a document with someone. So you give them a link. And when companies write this from scratch, there's so much stuff that can go wrong. Like this is something that's so easy to get wrong. So when I hear a company has share by link or sometimes called capability URLs, then I'm already thinking of like, how can I use that to get in and maybe like get some other information?
So what are the common issues that, or common, I suppose, risk areas that you come across?
So I think, like I mentioned, share by link.
But in terms of, but from, you know, the privacy side and the data protection side, what areas of the law is it that, you know, are most weak, or I suppose is it just the security itself?
So I think the issue of re-identification is not very well understood. And so that's something where there's tons, like it feels like every year or two, there's a new attack on like, this database was shared, it's safe. And then you get some privacy researchers who come in and say, oh no, I can re-identify the people. So I think like re-identifiability and like figuring out who people are in a data set that is called anonymous is a pretty classic problem.
Yeah.
I mentioned data deletion, data retention. And then the other thing that often comes up is access control. And particularly if you have a large company and you're concerned about insider risk, access control is super easy to do wrong. And some of that's just like the old like infrastructure that was developed in 1976 or whatever, when Unix first had access control. So we're still using some of, you know, like we're still basing stuff on that. And then it's just hard to get right. So you may think you're just adding one employee to the access list, but actually you added a group and that added 1,000 people.
Yeah.
So like, it's pretty easy to make mistakes there.
Well, it's kind of exposure to have, because one of the big risk areas we see is in supply chains. So, you know, you've got chains of processes, you know, potentially crossing borders and data flowing around these networks. Each individual step in that process has got its own unique risks, probably. And we usually find that people don't fully understand their supply chains when it comes to the processing of their personal data. So I'm just interested to see, you know, from a red teaming point of view, or even as a privacy engineer, whether you get engaged in supply chains and what you find if you do get engaged in them.
So by supply chain, you mean like actual products, like physical, tangible?
No, sorry. So I mean, like, you know, you've got a company that uses a processor who uses a SaaS platform that uses a third party that uses a third party that uses a third party type of thing. So it's all kind of data processors really related. So the better, well, an example is we use Salesforce as one of our major platforms. So that's a processor. They have a list of other processors that they use, including security experts and data centers and a whole range of other service providers. That's all part of the ecosystem that we have engaged by deploying Salesforce in our business. There's a limit to how far we can go in our due diligence on Salesforce. But, you know, for Salesforce, read Microsoft, read, you know, Xero, read Zoho, read HubSpot, read, you know, whatever you want. You know, that's where, really where I'm driving at, kind of that yeah. Processor of the personal data.
Yeah, honestly, I really feel that. Even just with like my small business and trying to figure out like, how do I add WooCommerce to my website? And then like reading, trying to go follow that chain of privacy policies. It's not something I've actually tested, but that's a good idea.
There's a question in the chat from Lawrence. So how do people test to know if the breaches that might be occurring are being reported or known to the organization? Or is it just waiting for the customer to notice? The unknown unknown, so to speak, unknown.
So this is potentially where we go and do an audit and they say, let's have a look at your breach register. And they say, look, it's empty. We've had no breaches. What, in 5 years, you've had no incidents, no breaches, no near misses, nothing? No, there's nothing on the register. Oh, right. It must have a failing reporting system, we would say.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, right? Let's say a breach has occurred, and then there's the time it takes for the organization to even notice, right? Like, it's completely possible that the attacker is so good that you just don't know. And so, of course, you don't tell the customer because you don't know that it happened. And then, I mean, I hope this doesn't happen too often, but then there's sort of the question of the company knows. But then how long does it take to tell the people involved? And one of the problems is it can actually be a little hard to do the forensics and figure out whose data was touched and whether any harm occurred. So there are some companies that take the approach of like, well, we don't know if harm occurred. We can't show that anything like really happened. So we would prefer not to have a notice. Or we prefer you sort of like not to write about it or, you know, not to report it. And then there are other companies that are like, we don't know. And then maybe in their breach notice, they'll say like, we don't know if anything really happened. But then people always interpret that as something bad happened. Mm. Right. So it may actually be the case that like someone was just coming in and poking around their network, but didn't actually get access to the data. If they don't leave like a nice log and trail, you don't always know what the attacker was doing.
Yeah. Have you got involved in forensics before? I mean, it's a fascinating area, isn't it?
I feel like I sit next to the people who know about that.
Ah, right. Okay. You have a friend that knows.
Yeah.
Part two.
I mean, and I do know for like, you know how like when you're in a hospital room and there's a lot of beeping sounds and you like stop paying attention to them because it's just too many beeping sounds. It's often the same for like security analysts. They may get a lot of notices and it's really hard to figure out like which ones to pay attention to because there's just like notices all the time. Mm. So, or like warnings or alerts. So like, I'm not trying to excuse the security community. I think most people in the security community are really trying to like pay attention and be aware and do the right thing when it comes to a breach. But I am sort of saying like, it's hard. I get why there are mistakes. I get why people don't like have full information.
Yeah. What's your take on the insider threat? I mean, we talked to the other week on the podcast about there's an article that said that a staggering number of IT professionals were selling their services on the dark web, you know, as being able to infiltrate databases. Is the insider threat a very real proposition in the work you do?
So honestly, that's something as a consultant, when I work with companies, I ask them, like, do you think insider threat is a risk? And usually for the small startups, they say like, no.
No, we trust everybody.
Yeah, we know everyone in this company. We're all dedicated. You know, we all have our potential stock options, you know, like whatever it is that like they say no. I mean, it only takes one disgruntled employee to get access to user data and to reshare it. Mm. So I guess like high harm, low probability.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. Yeah.
Michael said in the chat, we're used to it. It's always the same guy. Maybe they need a disciplinary. So with insider threats, that reminds me actually of that Kate Middleton, you know, the NHS case, I suppose, you know, where they were, does it also relate from a privacy perspective to, I suppose, purpose limitation and people accessing information when they shouldn't, but they're not necessarily, you know, using it maliciously, but they're not using it as they should be, or they're accessing it when they shouldn't be.
Yeah, absolutely. I was talking to someone who is like a hospital administrator and deals with this. And she had a story of someone who's like, didn't have a really good relationship with her daughter-in-law. So when her grandson came into the hospital, she looked up her grandson's records as sort of a loving grandmother. But that was a violation. And that sort of this question of like, should this nurse or doctor or whatever, the grandmother, should she be let go or reprimanded or like, yeah, good intention, but still violation of the policy.
Yeah, no, there's been quite a quite a few prosecutions on that basis. Well, what's the impact? I mean, you're in Switzerland, which is not part of the EU, but has got, you know, a similar law. So I'm just wondering the impact of the kind of cross jurisdictional work that you must get involved with. You know, you're not a lawyer, I get that. So you're on the kind of foot between the legal team and the engineering team. As a privacy engineer, surely does that just not confuse matters? You know, when you're having to deal with multiple jurisdictions.
Well,
would you gravitate to the highest level or the lowest level? What sort of kind of approaches have you seen?
So, all right. So, just a couple things, a couple responses to that. Hopefully, I can remember all of them. So, Switzerland just revised its privacy law in August, and it hadn't revised it since like 1984 or something, like since we were playing with Atari, or like how long ago was 19, you know, the 80s.
Sounds like, yes. Feels like, yes, I'm afraid.
But I mean, yeah, the point was definitely to be more aligned with GDPR, and there are a few key differences, but in a lot of ways, Switzerland is legally, from my understanding as an engineer, is pretty similar to GDPR. But I actually want to refer back to a point Jasmine made a few podcasts ago about how, like, if you do the ethical thing, then you can find the legal support for it, right? If you're if you're making this effort to do what the user wants, what they expect, that they're not going to find creepy, they might even be delighted in it. That's where I try to get companies to go. And I tend to hope that all the legal stuff will follow. So, like, does the user understand your notice? Is it true? Is it helpful? Right? Like, are you only keeping the data you need? Are you keeping it for the minimum amount of time? None of these, like, are really, you don't really need to know the letter of the law to think about those things. So that's how I sort of, like, hand wave around the legal stuff. But when it comes to compliance, I do also say, like, oh, you're dealing with health data, I don't know enough about this, go talk to a lawyer, right? Like, I will also sort of point out, like, oh, there's legal stuff there, go talk to the lawyer.
Yeah, well, it's good to do that signposting, isn't it? Because you got to know the limits of your kind of your scope and your role and the limits of, you know, what you should be advising on. So it's, it's a good approach.
It's a safer approach, definitely. I've got a question. So you mentioned that a lot of your customer base is in America. What is the general consensus and, you know, feeling towards privacy laws and data protection amongst the organizations that you deal with? Is there a general consensus, or does it depend on each organization or depend on the state? Because I was looking earlier, you know, with the new law that's been passed in Maryland, and I found on IAPP's website a map of the US, and it has on it which states have data protection legislation, which don't, which is in progression, etc. And it's broad ranging, really. I can share my screen so everyone can see it, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
So I'm going to give my thoughts on sort of, like, the cultural differences around privacy, and it has less to do with sort of the legal aspect, I think.
Exactly.
Like, that, go ahead and share your screen. Maybe I can keep talking at the same
time. Yeah, of course.
I think there is this sort of, like, compared to maybe continental Europe, what I've seen of it, there is this really, like, individualistic American attitude where, like, if you're breached, it's your own fault. Or, like, you're responsible for your own privacy, which is, and sort of less expectation from regulators to get ahead of the game. I think that's changing. I think people, like, there are more and more people who are saying, like, that hasn't really worked. Like, we don't actually have that much power in the privacy decision making. But that's definitely, like, from what I've seen, a cultural difference. And the other big cultural difference I see is around employee privacy, where in the US, there really is just this, like, if you're an employee, you don't have privacy from your boss or your employer. And that's something I've come across, particularly, like, I was working for Google in Switzerland. So I was working for an American company with a bunch of Europeans. And they just, this was like a constant thing where I was saying, like, when you talk to your American colleagues, they're going to have a different expectation here. Yeah. So someone's writing, yes, the cultural difference is huge. Yeah. So I think that's, like, a cultural difference. And I don't know about the law of employee privacy in Europe, but, like, it's probably not something you're going to see Americans clamoring for very soon, because it's just not part of their cultural expectation. In general, right? Like, all of this is, like, in general. Yeah. I can't speak for any particular American or European.
Yeah,
it's an interesting map. It's an interesting map, isn't it? Just looking at it, and, you know, the devil's in the detail. You know, the variation between the legislation in each state is, you know, again, the next step, isn't it? So,
yeah,
you know, is California the same as Texas, the same as Vancouver, if you're sat in the middle and you're working across all these states, or you're sat in Europe trying to work with all these states? You know, how complex a landscape is it?
Yeah,
honestly, I would love to see the correlation between, like, which parties these states vote for. Because if you just look at this, you sort of think, you see some of the green and blue are in like swing states or typically Democratic states. I don't know if there actually is a correlation, but that's interesting to me.
Mm. Yeah,
that sounds really like the task for a privacy engineer to me. So.
Yeah, can you get statistical significance with 50? I don't know.
Well, it's the whole of the population, isn't it? You know, in terms of the population of a state. So it should be able to arrive at a statistically significant result, probably, maybe. I don't know. I'm not the scientist here. You're the scientist.
Actually, so that was an interesting video that I saw on LinkedIn this week by a privacy expert who had previously run for office. And she was talking about the new privacy bill or the proposed bill. And giving this example of how public data was excluded, like, oh, public data, that's not private. And so voting records, not who you voted for, but whether you voted, are public record in the US. And she was explaining how she was able to infer whether someone was a member of a trade union based on whether their history of voting in the Democratic versus Republican primaries in her state. Which is really interesting. Like, I never would have known that like potential inference, but in this case, there was like an anti-trade union Republican who was running. Someone's nodding their head. They know more about it than me. So it's just like, it's always crazy all these inferences you can make from information that you're like, it's just whether they voted. Well, it's whether they voted in the Democratic primary or the Republican, and whether they did that for 2 years in a row versus three, like that starts to add up and tell a story.
That reminds me, because you mentioned yesterday that you worked on Waze, you know, testing for Waze when you was a part of Google, and how some of that information might have been requested and how you had to, you know, err on the side of caution with sharing that data with government agencies and so on, and how that information, if shared, you know, the risks involved around that and what conclusions can be drawn from that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really interesting, because there is, like, from a public policy perspective, you totally get why, like, governments want to know where the traffic jams are and where are people traveling the most, so they can use that, like, to maybe build better public transportation, right? Like, you're like, oh yeah, that is really valuable information, I can see how that would do a lot of good. But like, what would it take for Waze to actually give usable information to a government agency? Like, let's think that through. And that's where you can be a privacy engineer and really think through sort of like, can I reverse engineer this? If I share this data, could I re-identify it? And really think through like, what can you learn from this? And sometimes it can just be like, you know, general data obfuscation, like don't use detailed timestamps and so on. But other times you want to be more careful.
Yeah.
There are just things in the chat that I'm kind of distracted.
This is fascinating stuff, Rebecca. I mean, it really is. Just the way you think is great. You know, it's different to the way most of us think, but it's just great to have that, you know, in your team, you know, to have that privacy engineering thought process and analytical skills in your team must be really, really beneficial to people.
I hope so. I hope, like, I mean, I think everyone in privacy is like, wants to make the world a better place, and we want to protect human rights. So, like, I hope I'm making a difference.
I'm sure you are.
Yeah, I mean, even from us, we've learned so much in this podcast and leading up to it as well. Like, I've never heard of a privacy engineer before, but now I kind of want one.
I want to be one. Yeah.
It's, well, it's
I work with companies,
mind.
So I am a consultant. You can hire me.
But yeah, I actually can't believe I've just glanced at the time and that is the hour mark. But honestly, thank you so much for joining. It's been a really good session. I hope you felt the same and everyone listening.
Thank you all so much. And thanks for all the comments.
Yeah, sorry, I've not been particularly good at keeping up with the chat today. I've seen that there's been a lot going on and yeah, there's a lot going on all around. So apologies if any comments have been missed. But thank you, everyone, for joining. We'll be back next week for a GDPR radio session. But in the meantime, thank you again, Rebecca and Phil and Joe, as ever.
Yes, thank you, everyone. Yeah.
See you later.
Thanks, Rebecca. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
See you later.